The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to Luke. Now large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and he turned and said to them, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and child, brother and sister, yes, even life itself, cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost, to see whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going out to wage war against another king, will not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000? If he cannot, then while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, none of you can become my disciple if you do not give up all your possessions." The Gospel of the Lord. Holy God, we ask that you send your Spirit to light our hearts, our minds, and our imaginations on fire with your love and with your light. Amen. I guess I'll come back here since everybody's back here. Do you realize there are more people sitting in this quarter of the church than the entire rest of the place? And when your kids come, this is going to be so crowded. So I'm being serious. Not today. That'd be a little awkward. But let's just spread it out just a bit, okay? I mean, if I was new and I walked in and I sat down here, I'd make it about halfway through the service. Spread it out, if you would, please. And thank you for sitting up here, Dick. Did you know that some of the oldest mining activity in human history was done by the Aboriginal people of Western Australia? Did you know that? Jack says he does, and I believe him. Well, it was. And what they were mining for is ochre. Who knows what ochre is? I would hope so. The geologist is like, I do. if he's like, well, no, I'm like, okay. Ochre is a red, well, when it's finally mined, don't correct me when I'm wrong, is a red powdered substance that is a mineral that gets, I believe, its color from iron ore. Ooh, I was right. And it was used by the early Aboriginal people, still is actually to this day, in sacred rituals. Probably the most common image of the use of ochre, and it was you see this in the caves in France, and some other folks did it too, was you'll see that it's kind of a famous painting, a famous picture of a hand print on a wall of a cave that's all red around it except for where the handprint was. And that's caused by someone putting their hand on the wall and through a pipe blowing ochre at their hand. And it was a way to be seen by God. It was a way to identify yourself. And not like a signature, more of a kind of, do you see me? I am here. What's one of the very first projects kids do when they're little in school? They trace their hands, and if it's fall, they do something really stupid. They do what? They turn it into a turkey. Okay, great. When young parents pass away in the emergency room, frequently the social worker there will make a handprint in plaster of Paris so the children will have that to remember their parent by. So that handprint is a pretty significant thing. But back to the ochre for a second. So ochre being used for ritual purpose, or being, it was with the mining process in mining it, was considered to be a ritual itself. So mining became a sacred activity, and it was treated as such. Great care was taken, as little damage is done as possible. You've got to remember, these are people who went into the depths of the earth believing they were entering the mother from which they came to receive sacred things. In fact, the word that the Aboriginals use for ochre is the same word that they use for seed and... I just drew a blank on what it was. I apologize. If it comes back to my mind... Wow, totally forgot. But the same word for seed. And the idea was that they were receiving something that would become, go from that profane, from that ordinary, into something extraordinary, something sacred. So mining, the mining of sacred materials, was a sacred process. Pottery is very similar to that. In many cultures, even today, pottery is seen... embryo. That's the word. It's the same word. You knew I was going to get there, didn't you? So seed or embryo. See, it's a much better, more significant. Now that we have to go all the way back. No. But so pottery is seen in many cultures, even today, also as a sacred activity of turning the profane, the ordinary, you know, just basically mud into a useful, maybe day-to-day vessel, or into a sacred instrument, a sacred vessel. I showed him at 8 o'clock, but I didn't bring him in for today. I have two pottery chalices that are in the chapel, and one was an ordination gift from my parents, created by the Holy Rood in Massachusetts, the Convent of the Holy Rood in Massachusetts. And the other one, that's the brown one, for those of you who have seen it. And then the bluish one was actually potted by Tom Shaw, the now deceased bishop of Massachusetts, who was a dear friend and a great potter, and just out of the kindness of his heart gifted it to me one day. For whoever broke it this summer while I was gone, I have fixed it without any sign, so you don't have to worry about that now. So... But pottery is seen as a sacred experience. And if you think about it for a second, you know, if you've ever tried to throw, who's thrown a pot before on a wheel? It's not easy, is it? And this is the way it usually goes, about 95% of the time, even by professional potters. You make a ball, you throw it on the wheel, you center it, and you start working it, and in your mind, you have all this wonderful, magnificent image that's going to come to life, and it starts to wobble. And then it starts to shred, and then if you don't slow down, it starts to fly about the studio. And what's really cool about it is you can pick up all those pieces and start all over again with the exact same mound of mud. And eventually, if you're any good, you come up with a beautiful piece of art. It's a sacred experience to create beauty out of ugliness, to create the extraordinary out of the ordinary, to create the sacred out of the profane. And that's kind of who we are. We are that clump of mud and clay that God has spending our entire lives trying to form into that beautiful thing that we were created to become. Now, he's got to be, or she's got to be, the world's most frustrated potter. Because I don't know about you, but as a clump of clay, I do a lot of wobbling on the wheel. Some days are better than others. But those hands, those gentle and graceful and loving hands of the one who creates us, gathers all that stuff back together again and begins to grow it, to increase its volume and its height as it becomes what it was intended to be. when that lump of clay is just sitting there and God can see something beautiful. That's who we are. That's who our God is, creating us into something more than just this. But back to mining for a second. Just this past week, I got this kind of picture in my head, this metaphor of church as mining. Church when done its best, church when done well, church when done with the best of intentions is like a sacred mining activity where we mine the depths of our hearts and our souls and our communities to find the sacred. When we dig deeper and deeper, knowing that all of this mess really is something beautiful. I was thinking this morning as we were standing in the back and Priscilla was gathering the 127 children she has with her today. You know, I mean, every parent in here must have like 4 kids. some of you do. And I was just, that noise, and then the coffee, and the people gathering, and the look on the choir's face, like, why aren't we starting? And Vaughn going into his second little round of the intro that I could hear a little bit of disturbance in, because why aren't we starting? Not really. It's a messy thing we do. Church is a messy thing. You can't mine without getting dirty. I cannot think of any mining activity whatsoever that doesn't involve getting dirty. And church is like that. It's also like mining because it's dangerous. Sometimes literally and sometimes spiritually. Being in community is a dirty, dangerous activity. You could end up wounded. You could end up with your heart broken. I mean, it's like love, right? You know? One of the sad things about love is it hurts. But it's worth it. So church, like mining, is us gathering together in community to dig deeper and deeper in search of the sacred. While God continues to form us into better and better miners. And I will beat this metaphor to death. But think about it. You never mine alone, do you? I mean, they used to in ancient times, but nowadays, nobody mines alone. It's way too dangerous to do it alone. It's also way too unproductive. Mining is a community activity, so much so that whole cities and towns and villages are created around mines. Some of the oldest mines that we know of in Europe are also some of the oldest sites of habitation. People gather together in community in search of what they need, in search of sacred through a sacred experience of being together. And that's what we're called to be. That's what we are called into as Christians, as people of faith, as people gathered here under this roof. We are called to come together in community in search of the sacred. And sometimes that sacredness is not found in the most grand and profound places. Yes, the altar and the bread and the wine, the Eucharist, is a sacred moment. Sometimes music in church can just feel, it just lifts you up and it's grand and it's just, you just know it is. But sometimes it's a matter of just sitting next to somebody who you love. Or sitting next to somebody you met for the first time 30 seconds ago. It's about coming together for either a meal or just a burger and a dog in the garden. Sometimes the most sacred and holy things are the most ordinary. Ochre is just red dust. but it leaves a mark that says that I am, that I was, that someone made me. Simple, yet profound. And that's who we are called to be as church. People who come together, willing to get dirty, get hurt, but to explore what it means to be. As some of you know, and this is probably the last time I'll bring it up for a while, over the last month or so, I've been getting recertified in scuba diving. And yes, I passed. Yay! Okay, hey, you have no idea. But there's two rules of scuba. The first is don't hold your breath. And that's got all kinds of physiological reasons with your lungs and air gathering and whatever. The other one is never do it alone. Always dive with a buddy. Yesterday, a number of us, in fact, a number of people who are here today, the clergy, some of the clergy who are here today, sat in a meeting. Does anybody remember how beautiful yesterday was? We sat in a meeting that gathered at 8:30 and adjourned at 4. Now, when people say you've got a meeting from 9 to 4 on a Saturday, you in your head know you're going to get out at 2:30, right? Because you always do, right? 4 o'clock. It was safe church stuff, practices and principles and best practices and all that kind of stuff. But the second part of the day was a talk given by a psychologist who, I can't remember his name, David something or other, who's written a number of books. And one of his things is about anxiety and how in an anxious environment, our lizard brain takes over. That flight or fright thing, or freeze. And that we are living in a time of great anxiety. You can't turn on the news. You can't open up your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed or a newspaper, if anybody knows where you actually can get one these days, or your computer screen, and not experience some form of rising anxiety. And the church is smack dab in the midst of this, partially because we are human and we live out in that anxious world, but also because we as an institution don't know where we are going, what we are becoming. And in particular, for churches that don't know whether they will even exist a few weeks from now. We heard the story that happens all the time where the treasurer makes the report at the vestry or the council meeting and says, I've gone through the numbers, and at the rate in which we are spending money, we will have nothing left in 3 months. Anxiety, anxiety, anxiety. But somewhere in the midst of that, if we learn to do it together, if we learn to never hold our breath, we learn to breathe, pull it in and let it out. We can lower that anxiety and we can get back to the mining that we are called to do, the search for the sacred. Charlotte and I, it was interesting, we sat at the same table, not right next to each other, but at the same table, and she had her back to me because we were both looking forward and I was in the back of the table. And they were going through opened and closed systems, you know, places where anxiety is well managed and there's creativity and there's openness to change and, you know, openness to failure and whatever, whatever. And then closed systems where none of that is the case and the anxiety rides about like this constantly. And there's what, there were 80 people there, 75 people there, something like that. All clergy. And the question was, who works in an open system? Charlotte and I were the only two people in the entire room that raised our hands. And she couldn't see me, so she wasn't doing it because, like, oh, well, Bob's going to, so I have to. We have a gift that we have given each other. And that is, when we get anxious, We are there in it together. When we dive into the messiness of community life, we are there in it together. When we dig deeper and risk injury, we are there to support the other. That's who we are called to be. And that, I hope, is who we are becoming. So remember, two rules of scuba: don't hold your breath, and never do it alone.